actually 2019 was the first year that we reached 1 billion page views in a year, which for us is an amazing milestone.
Welcome everybody to Media Voices, the media focused podcast that takes a look behind the biggest media news stories of the week. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And that quote you've just heard is from Chris Stone, who is the executive producer of video and audio at the Evening Standard. No pressure, guys. So we talked about the role video plays in journalism, their decision to launch two podcasts late last year, and the innovation project he's leading in partnership with Google to create interactive audio news for smart speakers.
And speaking of podcasts, we are delighted to welcome Acast on board as a sponsor for the Publisher Podcast Awards. So we have a very exciting headline sponsor announcement coming later this week.
And if you want to be at the Publisher Podcast Awards, tickets are now on sale, but they are limited and are closing mid-February. So go to publisherpodcastawards.com/tickets to get your hands on them.
And our good friends at PPA, their awards turned 40 this year, and they've added podcasts to the lineup. Yay! So if your podcast is delivering engagement or whatever metrics you're after, they want to hear from you. Check it out on their website, which is ppaawards.co.uk.
Ahead of our interview this week, we're going to go through the news roundup. And it's been a busy old news week, but we're going to begin with some news about Google. And I think, Esther, we talked about this last week. Yes, you did. Yeah. So why don't you take us through exactly what Google has done?
Google has this week put the final nail in the coffin of third-party cookies. They've confirmed plans to, I quote, make them obsolete in the next 2 years. Now, we did actually talk about this a little bit 2 episodes ago in our Christmas special, which if you haven't listened, give it a listen, because it's not at all festive. It's just about like what's going to happen this year.
Talking about not festive. I put jingle bells at the start.
You did put jingle bells at the start, but if you can get past that, it's a really great episode. I think the key thing about this is that this should not be a surprise to anybody. Apple and Firefox both announced third-party tracker blocking last year. But the reason everybody is absolutely losing their minds over this is because Chrome has almost 3/4 of the browser market.
So why then has Google decided to do this now? What's it saying are its reasons?
It says that it is pivoting to privacy, did make me snort into my tea.
Absolutely, absolutely f*** off with your pivots.
It's got this goal that it wants to build a more private web. And like people are getting more conscious of this. You know, if Apple and Firefox are both offering really, really heavily, this depends how you define private. I mean, obviously the internet is not. but comparatively private browsers, Google has probably seen people kind of look at that and say, actually, if I'm interested in my privacy, Google is not the best place to be. People have been quite dramatic about this. Google are not blocking third-party cookies like instantly. They were testing blockers in one of their latest releases, but
They just sort of like implemented that.
Yeah. They then implemented what they were threatening to, what Firefox had done, which is you literally have a button you can say, I don't want any third-party cookies tracking me. But this proposal they've put out on their Chromium blog actually says that they're going to look to phase them out over 2 years. So this is like it's a transition period, guys.
Yeah, they haven't actually done anything yet, right?
No.
It's just that they've stated their intention.
Like Brexit, like Megxit,
really? You
third party cookie exit, where there is going to be a 2-year transition period where they're looking to phase out, and they are fundamentally in their site, they said that they're going to look for solutions so that it doesn't just tank the industry.
Yeah, nobody knows what that means, though, right? Could be better cookies.
That's true.
Universal IDs, or no one really knows.
So like ad tech companies are absolutely bummed out by this. Criteo, who are a really big ad tech company, their stock absolutely bombed.
Well, they built their house upon the sand.
So loads of vendors that have built up cookie reliant audience databases are pretty screwed unless they pivot pretty quickly.
Pivot.
But this is not Google killing ad tech, because, and actually this is the thing, is that it ends up being hugely beneficial to Google because...
Oh, no.
How? I bet they cannot believe their luck that this thing that Google is doing is benefiting Google by complete coincidence.
All the clicks and conversions will still be stored in Google instead of being broadcast to a ton of third parties. This is the way that the internet should run, but it benefits Google, it benefits Facebook, it benefits Amazon, because they all have this first party data. But it also benefits publishers, because publishers have first-party data.
Mm-hmm. No, in fact, I think we spoke about that in an old conversations episode.
Publishers have the potential.
No, all publishers have first-party data. Publishers are not yet using it properly.
Yeah, well, having and using is the point.
they almost might not have the expertise to use it.
Exactly, or the platforms or whatever. I mean, the one... That conversations episode definitely is interesting from this point of view because of the stuff that Permutive's doing, an immediate work to Permutive, and their case study is brilliant.
Mm.
Not to sound like we're banging on about Permutive, but they had like something like 135% increase in ad revenue after they went to their own data management platform, which is nuts.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of work that still has to be done. Like the buy side really still doesn't get what's happening here. There's a lot of education.
I think the part of that issue, though, is they don't know what the alternatives are.
Yeah.
What the alternative is to work directly with publishers, which is great, but when they're chasing scale, as advertisers inevitably will, then the only real way they've got is a network buy, or...
Which I suppose is why a lot of the ad alliances suddenly make a lot of sense. Because they've been prioritising that first-party data from the off.
Does this mean we actually might get a story of Pangea?
Well, I mean, Ozone and that lot, like this, again, I wonder if they saw this coming because that suddenly makes sense that they have this huge pool of first-party data that, I mean, it doesn't compare to Facebook, it doesn't compare to Google, but if you're looking to get back to contextual advertising, it makes so much sense and they're now probably, well, hopefully in a really good place. And the other thing is, it's going to be so nice to go on a website and know that you know who is cookieing you. And that your data
don't you just cannot turn that into a verb, for Christ's sake.
Yes, no. I can.
Oh, by my me. God.
But you're almost
as bad as home officing.
It's just that knowledge that your data isn't being passed to literally hundreds and hundreds of completely random organisations.
So the Media Voices view on this one is, yay!
Broadly positive, with some caveats.
Can I read out the statement from the ad industry trade bodies, though? Because this may be helpful. So the trade bodies 4A and ANA said that we are deeply disappointed that Google would unilaterally declare such a major change without prior consultation across the digital and advertising industries. And my response to that is, how could you not see this coming?
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Statement from Fleas. We are deeply disappointed that a dog would unilaterally declare such a major change without prior consultation.
Moving on.
Yeah. So the next big story this week is that Telegraph Media Group in the UK has pulled out of the ABC, or Audit Bureau of Circulation's, newspaper circulation audit.
Nice.
So the ABCs are a joint industry currency, or JIC, industry standard way of measuring and recording newspaper circulations. Effectively, it's as independent a way as possible of ensuring that papers are selling or circling as many print editions as they say they are.
So this is so that I can't say I've got like a million... I circulate a million copies of my magazine every month because I'll be like, you only circulate 20,000 copies.
Yeah, exactly. And they've been really useful for our industry because they've allowed us to chart almost the decline. You know, when people talk about print is dead, they point to these numbers. So the Telegraph is claiming that circulation is no longer a key metric for its subscriber-first strategy, which, well, you kind of scoff, but the reason that they gave is true. It's sort of true.
I'm laughing a little bit because I'm conflicted about this because I want to hate on the Telegraph, as is my left-leaning want. But they're kind of right.
Yeah.
Maybe for the wrong reasons, I don't know. But
well, to an extent, the ABCs aren't relevant to kind of this new digital subscriber-first market.
Okay, but what does this mean to advertisers, because I thought the ABC was a key metric that they went on for sort of assessing value and stuff.
It absolutely is.
Yeah. So the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising, or the IPA, have put out a statement with their Director General, Paul Bainsfair, saying that the IPA is extremely concerned by the news that the Telegraph is to pull out because the system was industry supported and produced, quote, trusted, independent and transparent data for ad buyers, which is absolutely the case. And what I think is really weird is if you go back to the Telegraph's last... annual review, they make a big play of print and how it's sort of attracting advertisers. So this seems a little bit hypocritical as well. But back to your point, Peter, you're right that it's no longer particularly the most relevant metric.
Well, if you look at their numbers from last year, the digital subs were up 44% last year. That took them past print subscribers. So the print subscribers are 213,000. The digital subscribers are 213,000 and the print was 209,000. They're trying to grow that to 1 million paying subscribers by 2023. None of that is reflected in these numbers.
No.
So as not a business, if that's where their business focus is, then there's no real value. But it does mean that, you know, why are you still publishing in print? What are you doing?
It's not that it's not going to measure them anymore.
No, absolutely.
It's just going to be another firm that does it.
Yeah, it's going to be
so that the advertisers can have the trust. But
they say it will be independently audited by Pricewaterhouse. So it's not they're not just saying, oh, guys, we just wrote our numbers on the back of this package here. Give us your money.
I don't know. It seems bizarre. It seems to me now there's a disincentive for other papers to remain opted in, because the bad press that you get every time the ABC releases this new, you know, their quarterly results or whatever, would seem now to just be, if you can opt out of that bad publicity, why would you not do that? I mean, I want to dredge up Clay Shirky's old argument that print and print circulations are heading towards another cliff here, because his argument is that there's a psychological point at which advertisers will look at these numbers and decide that it just isn't worth investing anymore.
Unless, I mean, you would imagine they've talked to advertisers about this before they did it.
Yeah, certainly.
You know, if you're a loyal Telegraph advertiser, you probably know where the circulation's heading. You're probably just milking it for as long as you can.
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me if they're doing a lot of bundles. You know, you book an online campaign and you get X in print or whatever.
And now onto the news in brief. And we're really going to have to rattle through this one because there are so many big stories this week.
Big stories. So Fortune Magazine is going behind a paywall next month, as well as having a major redesign of the magazine and the website. They're going to 10 issues a year in print. And they'll stop putting photos of business leaders on the covers, which is a weird decision, I guess. I mean, That's the point of Fortune, right? Instead, they're going with artistic concepts.
This is a very, very clever way of disguising the fact that they're cutting back print. We're going behind a paywall and we're cutting back print. Well, some actual good news. The New York Times has just passed its $800 million goal for annual digital revenue, a year ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. They now have more than 5 million total subscriptions. So I think 3.4 million of that is to the core news product, 600,000 to the crossword, and 900,000 in print. Yay, New York Times, that's amazing.
I have it on good authority from a former Fortune cover guy that it's actually the failing NYT. So I don't know what that says about this.
It's going to be great.
So WeChat is planning to put up paywalls for officially verified accounts on its platform to allow users to monetize their content. WeChat's previously done some really, really good stuff with enabling tipping creators. So this is one to watch. I mean,
Whoa. Before you go any further.
Yeah.
What the f*** is WeChat?
It's like WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram and everything else combined in China.
Right.
But it's got everything, like you can pay your bills on it. It's like Facebook, but it's got all the payment systems and stuff integrated with it.
So this is what Facebook would be like if we lived in a communist state.
Is
that the point?
I mean, it's what Facebook would like to be, I think.
Yeah, the fact that it does have all that stuff integrated does mean that micropayments have worked really well on it.
There's this fascinating case study where it's almost taken over some of the traditions that have been kind of long established on China. So there's this practice of giving people money as a gift in red envelopes.
Nicey, dialogue.
And then, but WeChat just allows that digitally. They've completely co-opted kind of this red envelope format, and people just pay one another with this kind of digital red envelope. It's fascinating.
Yeah, there are some huge issues with WeChat as well, but I think there's not enough
really?
Time in this episode.
Some huge issues? Really? Facebook. Facebook Klaxon. They've backed off from their efforts to sell ads in WhatsApp, which I guess is news. We're all happy about that.
Yeah.
So that was why the creators resigned, I guess, about 18 months ago. But it's also disbanded the team set up to find the best ways to integrate ads into the service. So they've basically just backed right off of selling ads in WhatsApp.
Turkey has restored access to Wikipedia after 2 years. So it blocked the site back in 2017 when Wikipedia refused to remove unflattering references to Turkey's relationship with Syrian militants and terrorists.
Have you two noticed a sea change in how people talk about Wikipedia these days? It used to be, you know, seen as this kind of byword for unreliable online information. And now that everybody's unreliable online, I think that people have really come around to Wikipedia. Well,
it's the referencing, isn't it? Like, if you read something on Wikipedia, check the reference.
Yeah, absolutely. The Atlantic has launched a fiction section, which is dedicated to publishing original fiction regularly on the site, in addition to several times each year in the magazine. I saw people really responding positively to this.
I think this has been inspired by the fact that the political coverage half the time is all about other people's fictions.
I should say there are definitely some publishers that I would say already have dedicated fiction sections.
Dennis Publishing is launching its weekly news magazine for kids, The Week Junior, in the US.
Nice.
In print. They reckon this is the first weekly news print magazine launch in the US since The Week itself launched in 2001. And just to prove that our fingers are well and truly on the pulse, we're going to be talking to them very soon.
Does that make us the first podcast to talk about the first weekly news print magazine to launch in the US since 2001?
I think that's quite a low bar. And the Guardian Media Group has appointed Annette Thomas, who is a neuroscientist and academic publisher, as their new chief exec. So she'll be focused on helping the publisher develop a financially stable future after they finally broke even last year. This week, I spoke to Chris Stone, who is the executive producer of audio and video at the Evening Standard. So I started by asking him what his role at the Evening Standard involves and how he ended up getting into video production for publishers.
I have been at the Evening Standard for a couple of years now. I lead a video and audio team. We're sort of a cohesive unit that all work together but have two distinct sections to it. The video team is what I started doing, and then the audio team is new as of about a year ago. And, you know, we cover everything from breaking news to lifestyle features. And then, you know, in the audio side, we've got short form audio news content and podcasts as well. So I sort of oversee about nine people at the Standard. And then before that, I was at the Telegraph for 5 years, where I was producing lifestyle video content and sort of latterly kind of documentaries and news features.
So pretty much anything and everything video then?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been working in video since before online video was a thing. I got my first job in London was very early days of online video, working for a website producing how-to content. And then that was about the time that YouTube was born. And so, you know, we had like this independent platform, and then YouTube started and quickly sort of hoovered up a lot of the market, and so had to change our strategy and all sorts. So yeah, I've been working in online video from the outset, and then had a stint in broadcast as well, producing TV documentaries and a bit of current affairs, bit of sort of lifestyle-y documentary, factual entertainment stuff. Did that for a few years and then got the job at the Telegraph. So then I've been working for publishers for the last 7 years.
That's quite unusual, because often people who are trained in video back, I don't want to say back then, but they before online video tended to go into broadcasts. So you tend to get people coming out of the broadcast world into publishing.
Yeah. Well, yes. I studied TV production at Bournemouth University at the time when you know, video was just being talked about as an online proposition. And I can remember sitting in seminars having debates about whether broadcast TV was going to converge with the internet and that sort of thing. So I thought I was going to be a TV documentary maker, and then pretty quickly realized that the jobs market was going in the direction of producing content for online.
I think it's quite interesting where you are in the publisher space, because there was quite a fallout sort of 2018, 2019 with the great pivot to video that a lot of publishers went for. I know quite a few sort of struggled to see real returns on investment. Is video something that only works for sort of certain type of publishers, like news publishers, or can it work for everybody if it's done right?
Okay, so there's a couple of things there. On the pivot to video thing, I think a lot of people got stung by the fact that, you know, the return on investment wasn't immediate. And I think partly that was because a lot of people were at the behest of the platforms. Basically, you know, the publishing world had been promised a lot of things by platforms. You know, there would be this great pivot to video, and by 2020, all of your newsfeed would be video and video, video, video. And that's, you know, that's kind of true. I think a lot of, you know, a lot of the kind of social platforms and things, video is a massive part of what they do. But I don't think necessarily the profitability followed as quickly as maybe the boards of the publishers, the people that were counting the money and making sure that everything was making their business work properly, would have liked to have seen. At least that's the sort of the feeling that I get from, you know, a couple of levels down the ladder, yeah, as it were.
Yeah.
And I've been in meetings since between platforms and groups of publishers where publishers have clearly learned from that. We now are in a position where if platforms are promising stuff to publishers, then almost as one, the publishers are basically saying, that sounds fine, but what's in it for us and how do we make it work for our business? And where's the roadmap to profitability and monetization? And I think that's, you know, in order to get content from publishers, platforms need to be smart about making sure that there is a route to that. It has to be a symbiotic relationship. So, yeah, I mean, that pivot to video clearly had an impact on the way that publishers, I think, view working with platforms, and rightly so. I think it's, you know, we've got our businesses to run and they've got theirs, so we've got to make sure it works for everybody. And then the second question about, does video work for all publishers? I think the thing is, video can be very expensive to produce. So something that I've tried to do at the Evening Standard is be very careful about making our efforts cost effective. We've got to start with where our audience is and do something really well and start building our traffic in one area before we can start branching out into some of the other areas that maybe we need to grow that audience in and work a bit harder for. So, you know, for us, that's been breaking news. When I joined, we sort of redoubled our focus on breaking news content and making sure that we had the relevant breaking news clips at the top of all the articles that we could, and make sure that we're targeting high trafficking articles and giving our audience the most relevant video content to them, what they were looking for. And that, you know, that's different to what some other publishers do. Some people just throw video at absolutely everything, which is also a perfectly valid strategy. But I think, you know, for us, it was about kind of making it relevant to the user experience, and but also like in volume in the areas that had the highest traffic, and then trying to build out from there. So I think one of the areas that I think is most profitable but also most challenging to attract an audience to and keep them with you and engaged is sort of in the more lifestyle areas. You know, when a breaking news event happens, it's, you know, there's obviously massive spikes in traffic, and everybody's very interested in this one thing that's happening. And so it's actually quite easy to serve video to that audience because there's people out there that are looking for that right then. But it tends to be a shorter tail, and that spike will disappear fairly quickly, and then you'll be on to the next thing. lifestyle content and kind of features content and documentary content, I think you have to work a little bit harder at your strategy to make sure that your audience is going to be there for probably over a longer time frame. So latterly, I've been working quite closely looking at where our traffic's coming from and looking at the articles on the Evening Standard website in the lifestyle sections that are doing particularly well, and then creating a video strategy around those types of articles, and, you know, really trying to pay close attention to targeting stuff for SEO and search. So I think video can work for all publishers, but you need a different strategy depending on what kind of publisher you are.
And the Evening Standard, certainly those of us in London, mainly know it for the free print edition that gets handed out at tube stations in the UK. So where do video and audio fit into that, given that print, there's such a heavy reliance on print, especially for that brand?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I mean, print is obviously massively important. It's the central identifying factor of our brand. You know, the reason people know the Evening Standard is because it's synonymous with London, and you know, you see people every day reading our print edition on the tube. But equally, if you look at the way the print market is going across the board, you know, print figures are declining, and when you look at people on the tube, you'll see just as many, if not more, you know, looking at screens and listening to headphones. So I think the Evening Standard has to be responsive to that. And we've, over the last sort of 2 or 3 years, really expanded our digital offering. I think in February this year, we passed the 100 million page view mark. And
wow.
Then, yeah, and then at the end of this year, we actually, 2019 was the first year that we reached a billion page views in a year, which for us is an amazing milestone. You know, I mean, it's all relative, right? But for us, it's significant. And also, you know, that audience is, a digital audience is by its nature not restricted to geography. So what we've got is a great opportunity to build a digital brand that capitalizes on that existing London audience, provides a unique London perspective on the events of the world, but is able to reach beyond our geographic boundaries and takes our kind of editorial perspective. You know, we are, you know, we're positive, we're cosmopolitan, we're fairly politically centrist, we're diverse and inclusive like London is. You know, we take all of that to a global audience and, you know, then you've got a really interesting proposition. Obviously, video and audio is, you know, a fantastic and really important part of that. I mean, video is really important to us because obviously you're looking at the user experience and what people are expecting when they come to a story. You know, they want to see video. They want, if this, particularly if it's a video story, you know, if it's about a world event that's happened, they want to see the video of that thing happening. That sounds obvious, but it's true. So that's a central part of it. But also, you know, it's also really important to us for things like dwell time and user engagement and of course the, you know, the question of how do you make a digital proposition profitable. Well, video can command quite high CPM, so can be a very profitable part of our kind of digital ecosystem. So digital audio is obviously having a real moment and has been since about 2014 and the kind of the podcast renaissance. But I think the technology is very exciting at the moment, and I think is changing the way that we interact with audio and the web. And I think in terms of building a comprehensive digital strategy, audio has to be really important because that's where audiences are going, particularly our commuter audience, the amount of people that are listening to podcasts on a daily basis. For some, that's their chief way of interacting with the news. So we need to position ourselves there so that we can meet our existing audience where they've moved to and attract new audiences that are already inhabiting that kind of listening space instead of reading.
Which fits beautifully into my next question, which is you guys have launched two podcasts last year, The Leader and Women Tech Charge. So what was some of the reasoning behind launching these?
So I think there is clearly an audio friendly audience. People are maybe eschewing reading articles online or picking up a newspaper in favor of listening to podcasts. That's a space that our audience is moving into. So it's worth experimenting with figuring out if we can move into that space to meet our audience where they're going. So we have some pretty clear brand values that our audience associate with us and like. So we wanted to produce some podcasts that communicate those brand values and meet that audience where they are with the values they're interested in. I mean, so what can we do that will fit into that space? Well, then we happen to meet the amazing Anne-Maria Maffedon, who hosts our Women Tech Charge podcast now. And we just thought she was extraordinary. And we had a successful Women in Tech product online that our tech reporter Amelia Heathman was doing. Anne-Marie was open to the idea of doing a podcast. We looked at the podcast market and thought, well, there's a gap for actually we worked with we spoke to Apple and Acast and they agreed, you know, there's a gap for female hosted podcasts for a very intelligent female audience. I mean, historically podcasts have skewed white male. So, you know, there's a gap in the market there. So we put two and two together and came up with Women Tech Charge. Anne-Marie has been completely central to that and is a really fantastic host, very knowledgeable in the subject area. All of our guests know her and love her. And you get some amazing stories out of these incredible women who are doing amazing things in the world of tech. You know, we've had space engineers and spies and inventors and developers and all sorts of very interesting people talking about their experiences of being a woman in a male dominated environment and very exciting sort of edge of the tech scene. So it brings our brand values all together. That's Women Take Charge. And then the leader is, you know, very much the voice of the paper in audio. You know, we wanted something that represented the brand more fully in the areas that people know it for. I think what's interesting is that Women Take Charge was very much a deliberate going after a niche audience, like a very specific, we want to speak to women working in the tech sector or interested in working in the tech sector. That's, you know, by virtue of its definition, a fairly defined audience. The leader, we wanted to do something in kind of news and politics and analysis because that's what people come to the Evening Standard for. They know us as a news brand, so we wanted to represent that in audio. And obviously then if you're doing news, it kind of makes sense to do it daily. Obviously there's a fairly strong track record of lots of other people having lots of success doing daily news podcasts, and it seemed like a very natural fit for our brand. So that's what we wanted to do. And it's, you know, and we're incredibly proud of it. It's a fantastic podcast. And David Marsland, who hosts it, has been doing an incredible job. You know, he's well liked around the newsroom and people, you know, he came in to do the podcast and they very quickly built up rapport with all the journalists that he works with. And they are keen to be on the podcast. They're keen to talk about some of the scoops that they've had. You know, we've had this is the best thing about doing a podcast, is that you get to kind of show off your best stuff. So we had Robert Jobson, our royal editor, had an exclusive he had a front page that then got picked up around the world. So he scooped the world on the palace reaction inside the palace on the news from Harry and Meghan. So the day after Harry and Meghan announced their kind of bombshell desire to change their roles within the royal family, Robert had this fantastic exclusive look inside what the palace's reaction was. And of course, he could bring that to the podcast and talk about it more fully. And what's brilliant is that obviously these journalists are amazing characters in their own right. So Robert is a wealth of knowledge, an extraordinary character. And so being able to put him in front of a mic and allow him to talk about that in more detail really brings something different to the audience, that it's not just a written report, but it's also then, you know, you're bringing in the personality of the people that are working for you, and then the brand starts to have a bit more color and character. You know, we've had extraordinary listener interest in our coverage of Iran and some of the stuff around Donald Trump's impeachment. We've had David Gardner on recently, who's our US correspondent, talking about the Trump impeachment stuff. And then, not to even mention all the amazing politics journalists that we've got and the coverage that we can do there. And the reason we launched The Leader at the time that we did was because we had an extraordinary time in British politics, and we were able to bring our comment and analysis to a new audience through The Leader in that extraordinary time. So, you know, we've had George Osborne on the podcast talking about his view on what Boris Johnson should be doing around Brexit and what's likely to happen with the general election. There's so many I haven't mentioned. Ayesha Hazarika on the Labour Party. You know, she used to work for the Labour Party as an advisor. And so her perspective on what's going to be happening with the Labour leadership is second to none. You know, it's a really interesting insight. So anyway, so all of this is to say, it's a fantastic opportunity for us to bring out the best of our journalism to the audience where they are in 2020, which a lot of them is listening to audio.
So the last thing I wanted to touch on was your project with Google that you're working on. Can you talk a bit about what that involves and what you're hoping to achieve with it?
So yes, so you'll be aware of the kind of the narrative news experience on Google when you talk to your smart speaker. Or your Android on your phone, you say, play me the news, and it will give you a bulletin that is like a radio bulletin, which is fine, but it's sort of a traditional radio news experience. And so the product that Google have created is a sort of a next generation of that, which is now live in the US, which creates a curated news feed drawn from multiple different publishers. So you'll have, you know, say five top stories all drawn from different publishers. And then as you continue listening to it, it'll start to serve you some longer content. And then eventually you might end up listening to a podcast. So it creates it's like a Google News, but in audio. Now, this is kind of one of those examples of Google saying, hey, we've got this really cool thing, come and put some content into it and we'll build an audience together. But of course, you know, that is exactly the situation that we were talking about earlier, where the publishers then to have something in return. So Google, you know, have partnered with a number of publishers around the world to get this going, and we're one of them. And that has been a really interesting project for us and has basically allowed us to build out our audio capability. And so out of that also comes the opportunity to make podcasts and meet audiences. So we've got a team of three or four people working on the Google News content, and they're turning out about 55 stories a day into that ecosystem. So those are short form, single topic stories of about 30 seconds to a minute each. You start to get into kind of mini podcast territory. So part of our tactics has been to take the content from the leader and break that up into three individual parts and serve that into the Google system as well. Now, we've seen some quite interesting audience figures from that, you know, enough to make it continue to be interesting to us. And what's interesting as well is that currently for a long time it was only in beta, but now it's been launched. It's going out into the States. So we're publishing new audio content every day that's reaching a US audience in not insignificant numbers. Like if it was an individual podcast, you'd be delighted with some of the numbers. But, you know, I think what's really interesting is that now you're talking about interactive audio, because you're talking to a thing, it's giving you news audio, and then you've got the opportunity to interact with that. You can, you know, you can skip it, you can go back, you can say, I like this, and you can, you know, you can go through the app to nominate certain publishers that you're interested in. And particularly when you get into that second bit, where you're into the longer content, then you're starting to look at opportunities to hand people off to your podcasts. Or you're, you know, on the roadmap in the future, perhaps you could be talking to this stuff in your car, and then you're listening to it on your smart speaker in the morning, and then you're listening to it in your car on the commute if you're in the US, or if you commute by car in the UK, and then, you know, maybe you're interacting with Android later on, you're home watching your TV, and you know, you can listen to it before you go to bed or something. But that creates lots of interesting interaction opportunities. If you can hand people off from one product to another, then you end up with effectively a web of audio content. Now, what does that sound like? It sounds like the internet, but in audio form. You know, we're increasingly interacting with the internet via voice, which means that audio is the natural way for it to be served, which means that you're at the beginnings of kind of a nascent audio web. So that means that you can create audiences at different points along that web, and then you start to get network effects because you can refer them from one product to another. So you're not just looking at a linear kind of podcast network, but you're starting to get
like an ecosystem.
You're starting to get an ecosystem that you can invite people into and audiences can move around in, which is really exciting, because one of the challenges of producing podcasts that are the really big standout ones, you go to a publisher and you say, I want to produce something incredibly expensive. And they say, well, where's the audience for that? If you've got an ecosystem where you've already got a massive audience and you can encourage that audience to move over into the podcast, which is on a similar subject, then suddenly you've got evidence to say, this is worth investing in. We know that the audience really like this stuff. If we do a flagship piece of content around this subject area, then it's more than just a shot in the dark.
The last question we ask all our guests is what the last thing is you read, watched, or listened to which really affected you.
I'm going to go with the BBC's podcast series Fake Heiress, which I binge listened in one evening and one morning after being recommended it by the lady that edits our leader podcast, a girl called Rachel Abbott. She said, I think you should listen to this. I think you'd like it. And I did. I think it was a brilliant piece of narrative storytelling. And what was really interesting, so it was Fake Heiress is a 6-part documentary about Anna Delvey, who was a fraudster who, you know, cast herself as a New York socialite and heiress to a massive fortune, but was, you know, basically it was all lies and she was conning everybody. And I think what they did really well was the way that they wove together documentary and drama. So they had a journalist reporting the story, and then they had a radio drama writer and director, and a bunch of actors kind of doing the story as a drama piece. And they wove those two things together, and I think they did it really well.
So just a quick reminder that one of the events we are media partners for, Making Publishing Pay, is coming up. That runs from the 25th to the 26th of February, looking at what the future of your publishing business looks like. We are leading a roundtable on how to launch a podcast that enhances your brand and can drive subscriptions or ad revenue. So see you there.
If you would like to stay in contact with us during the week when I know you miss us, you can go to voices.media, which is our website. On there, you'll find all the previous episodes, some little bits of analysis that we've written, and links to everything else that we've put around the web. You can also sign up to our newsletter there. That goes out every Wednesday. It includes a link to the latest episode and some of the little tidbits as well.
And if you want to follow us every single day, get on Twitter. We are at Media Voices Pod for Media Voices News. And also, if you want to stay well up to date with what's going on with the Publisher Podcast Awards, you can follow Pub Pod Awards.
But until next week, when we will be back with another whistle-stop tour through all the media news and views, thank you very much for listening to Media Voices. Please do share it if you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.